Phase one of the state's reopening started Monday, and we are staying focused there this week. Houses of worship, manufacturing, construction reopened, and a host of other businesses will join them next Monday, all with safety restrictions in place. Stay at home is now safer at home, just in time for Memorial Day weekend. Someone is responsible for enacting and enforcing all these guidelines, and that's going to be hard. On the line to talk about it is Marty Martinez, Boston's Chief of Health and Human Services. Marty, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So let's just start with your initial reactions to the governor's plan Monday.
Suzanne, I think from the city's perspective, obviously it's a tough process to try to come back from where we've been with COVID. And I think the governor and the team's plan of this phased reopening, we support sort of the caution that's in it. And I actually think that, a lot of thought went into trying to create the right mechanisms and, the right things to open up when. But again, it's a tough situation and nothing was going to be perfect. But I do think a lot of thought went into it. So we're anxious to see how it unfolds.
One of the points of differentiation is the reopening of offices to sort of 25% of usual capacity. In the governor's plan, it's the 25th of May for most places, June 1st for Boston, but Mayor Walsh has expressed some concern about that. What is it about the amount and the timeline that causes the concern?
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern is, as the capital city, we are a city of, 700,000 folks, and on a given day when people come into work in the city on a normal times, our population, expands greatly. So we got a lot of people coming into businesses here in the city, and I think the mayor is rightfully concerned that businesses are ready to do the work necessary to encourage folks to stay home, make sure there's social distancing in the workplace, make sure that places are prepared with PPE and plans to really ensure that folks can keep distance from each other, but also keep employees safe, which I think is a really important piece for the mayor to make sure is the key. So I think the June 1st date gives us some more time, but the mayor he's been clear, we need to make sure the guidelines fit Boston, not just the entire state, which is obviously important, but that they fit Boston, which is more dense, has more people coming in, and we need to make sure that we can focus on safety and not having any additional spread or spikes in the infections.
So what timeline and percentage would be more comfortable for the city?
Yeah, I mean, I think the mayor understands that June 1st is the timeline that the governor's laid out, which is, we were appreciative of and have to advocate for some additional time. I think we're still looking right now. I mean, the mayor has tasked us to sort of work together as senior leaders and his team to figure out what percentage does feel like the right fit, and just as important, what guidelines are needed for offices to be able to do that. So we're looking at best practices, some national standards, and some input coming in to help us craft guidelines that we will share next week so that businesses can look at that. I'm not sure it's going to be a hard fit, 25% or lower, if you will, but it's definitely going to lay out a way for businesses to do it because we have to do it in a cautious way or we'll be back right where we are today again.
Marty, you made reference to the fact that Boston's a capital city, 700,000 residents. The governor's been pretty clear that his approach was not going to be a regional approach or a city-by-city approach, but a statewide approach, then with discretion for different cities. Should there be more of a city-by-city variation or regional approach? And how does Boston fundamentally need to do this differently than some other locales in the state?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such an important question and an important consideration. I mean, we all want our economy and our society to come back. We all want that, right? But moving too quickly is easily could cause spikes in cases and not only harm people's physical health, but the economic recovery we're trying to put into place. So for the city of Boston, I mean, we put a lot of input and guidance into the state's plan. And so we understand that the governor has to take a larger approach. But for the city of Boston, we have to make sure that any specific things that we open up, the way we will open them up, we will make sure to advocate based on what we see here on the ground. So a great example of that is, Houses of Worship, we're able to start having folks in them this week. And the mayor has been clear that his guidance around that has been asking seniors to hold off on going back to church or going back to their place of worship, even if the services do restart, and asking faith leaders to really think about older parishioners and folks to think about those restrictions and potentially not be inviting everyone back. the state may be ready for that, but in many of our communities, our infections rates are still high. We're still focused on creating greater access to testing. So in Boston specific, we have to look at Boston specific data, and we have to make sure that as we're opening with that understanding, and that's what the mayor's committed to doing.
Marty, I want to shift gears a little bit. I'm sure you are acutely aware that we have a beautiful 3-day weekend coming up. Do you have any worries about people gathering in big groups, given what's coming?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the beautiful day that's coming, I think next week is also going to be a beautiful week. And I think there's no question it's a challenge, right? And we know that the desire to go to a beach or the desire to go to a park or a cookout or all those things are in everyone's mind. And so we can't caution enough that people need to be mindful of the risks that are associated. We have to remember that I think today we have 100 new cases here in the city of Boston. I think we had reporting, 6 or 7 new deaths just today. COVID-19 isn't going away because we start to loosen restrictions or because it's nice outside. And so it's still here. We need people to practice physical social distancing, to wear facial coverings, to wash their hands, and to avoid unessential gatherings at all possible. We know that folks want to be outside. I want to be outside. The mayor wants to be outside, all those good things. But we have to be cautious longer and really do it for everyone, not just ourselves, but for those who are most vulnerable to what's in front of us.
So what might enforcement look like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the mayor doesn't want to have to, you know, implement enforcement in the way that we think about it, right? We're not asking police to, you know, step up patrols in this way or that way, but we're really leaning into our fellow Bostonians. I mean, I think our Bostonians have done a really great job so far of trying their best to be socially distant and to adhere to measures, and I appreciate that, and so does the mayor. And so we're really hoping and leaning in on doing it for the common good. You may feel fine. You may not feel like this is going to impact you, but it's taken the lives of almost 600 of your neighbors, and 12,000 folks have it across the city or have had it. So enforcement isn't what we're focused on. We're really focusing on the goodwill, and you know, our city cares deeply about our neighbors and each other, and so that's really what we're leaning in on.
I do hear you about that, and I also hear you that this is not a law enforcement orientation for the city, but I do want to talk about race for a minute. Here in the Commonwealth, yeah, we already have an understanding and a conversation about the gross disparities in vulnerability to COVID-19 based on race. We're hearing out of New York really stark racial disparities in social distancing enforcement. New York Times and Wall Street Journal did analysis of police data showing that more than 80% of those who received summonses were Black or Hispanic. So implicit bias is real, even how we relate with each other in a community. How
right.
does Boston approach enforcement mindful of bias and ensuring equity?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a central point that I think the mayor's continued to make, and it's been important to us all along. You know, when we were asked about facial coverings and how are we going to ensure people were doing it, we've been clear that we wanted to have a balanced approach of, you know, really pushing and really advocating and really lifting up by example the need for them and encouraging folks to sort of understand why to wear them, but being very mindful that the disproportionate impact of not only the way this can play out and the but some of the news we've seen across the country about how it's playing out. And so we've been hyper-focused not only on enforcement like that, not only on looking at our interactions in our communities, but we've also taken an equity lens to the work in general. You know, every single day we're looking at how COVID-19's played out in our Black and Latinx communities, and that's been a disproportionately sort of result and impact. We see that in the cases. We see that in, you know, who's in our hospitals. So we know it's playing out that way, and so as we're focused on ensuring that we combat those inequities, we have to look at all the inequities that are in front of us. And so we're doing that, and this has been a primary concern of the mayor's that he wants to make sure we're focused on. And so that's absolutely been one of the concerns about having any rampant enforcement, and that's why we've been leaning in on the messaging, because we don't want to have some of those same issues we're seeing in other cities.
And that is Boston Health and Human Services Chief Marty Martinez. I appreciate you taking time out to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Community needs and approaches are going to differ as we begin reopening. Stephen Katsourinas is the chair of the Provincetown Board of Health and the owner and proprietor of the 8 Dyer Hotel in Provincetown. Provincetown is approaching what is usually a very busy Memorial Day weekend there. Stephen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So what has changed on the ground in Provincetown since the first phase of reopening started on Monday?
Well, really not a lot has changed because Provincetown has been very, I think, cautious throughout this entire process as a result of really widespread community support for all of the advisories. We have had very few cases, and that's really been great. Of course, it sets the expectation pretty high as we go into a season where we know more and more people are coming to visit. So over the winter, and as COVID first began to appear in our community, it was primarily our year-round population. Now we have seasonal homeowners who come for the summer. They're beginning to arrive, and now we're expecting to see some travelers, some visitors for the day or for the weekend, although leisure travel is not permitted under the governor's current order, and our Board of Health is responsible for enforcing the ban on short-term rentals, and we have been doing that with the expectation that as we roll into this weekend, we are going to not see the kinds of crowds we've seen in the past. And, of course, we hope that our culture of social distancing and mask wearing, Provincetown was recently recognized as the community in the Commonwealth with the highest rate of observed mask wearing at 97%. We hope that visitors will see that and will take it on board so that we can keep everyone safe.
So why are you guys so highly compliant, and how do you then enforce for people who aren't?
So it's a great question. I would say that there's a very great communitarian spirit in this town, especially as we have been in our winter season where people don't have a lot of income and people have to share and care for each other. And so, you know, to have this sort of a rise in the middle of March here gave us a sense of caring for each other, which is always here. But, a tragedy like this, a pandemic like this, brings people together. And we really have been of one mind of what we need to do and how to do it. And so people have been great, and the compliance has been great. I mean, it's strange to walk down the middle of Commercial Street on a Wednesday and literally see almost no one. So, That's been great. Now, as people come in...
No, wait, I want to stop you there. I do want to stop you there for a second, Stephen. So on the one hand, with one hand, it makes sense to me that it's great to see no one on the streets on a Wednesday afternoon, but you're also a business owner. As a business owner, how does it feel to see no one on the streets on a Wednesday afternoon?
Well, if this was a different year, I would be shocked at what I'm seeing, and I would be dismayed at what I'm seeing. But I think that we all have an understanding, and the businesses in Provincetown have been really great partners. They usually are, but particularly in this situation. So, for example, in March, the inns voluntarily shut down well before there was a local or the governor's order to do so. So people realize that we're not going to have a tourism economy if we don't shut down now in order to save people's lives and to stand up for the proposition that we can care for each other, that we can get through this together, and that when it is safe for people to come to Provincetown, that we will be here and we'll be open. Now, some businesses are going to struggle. There's no doubt about that. They already are. But there's not much that we can do. And this is not the kind of community in Provincetown where people are going to put themselves first and put the rest of the community or our visitors into a place of risk. And so, like I said, the compliance is never 100%, but it's very high and it's very consistent. So as we look now into the coming weekend, we have signs up that encourage people to wear masks. Masks are required in businesses. Businesses are seconding that when people try to come in. If they're not wearing a mask, we offer masks to people. You know, there's been a big focus on how to make sure that we've got the facilities for people to hand wash. So we know that people are coming. And so we're in a little bit of a conundrum because on the one hand, we don't want to encourage people to come. But on the other hand, that's not a plan. Wishing people won't come isn't a plan. So we have developed plans for how to handle people when they do come. And last couple of weekends have been busier than before. But still, we see that people are respectful, and we just continue to try to encourage people to do the right thing and to care for each other by, you know, we say, I'm wearing a mask to protect you and me. And, the mask predominantly protects the other person if you were to be sick.
That's Stephen Katsourinis, chair of the Provincetown Board of Health. I appreciate you joining us today, and good luck this weekend.
Thanks, appreciate it.
There have been rumblings this week from all the major professional sports leagues as they work on possible plans to return. But just because they aren't playing yet doesn't mean there's nothing to talk about in the world of sports.
And forward from the University of New Hampshire,
that would be Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
All right, listen, other than fulfilling a fantasy you've had since you were 12 years old, why did you want to do that intro?
No, I was joking. I've done that about 10,000 times as a 12-year-old in the driveway. That is obviously the iconic song for the intro of the 1990 Chicago Bulls. This past Sunday was the last episode of The Last Dance. If you hadn't heard of that, it's an ESPN documentary, a 10-part series. The director is actually from your neck of the woods, Tiziana, Newton, Mass. His name is Jason Hare.
Yeah.
And it basically focuses on Jordan's final season with the Bulls, the 1997-98 championship run. It was the franchise's sixth championship, Jordan's sixth championship, their second three-peat. But really, it kind of uses that season as a way to launch back throughout Jordan's entire career. And this thing just became an absolute cultural phenomenon. Folks, it averaged almost 6 million same-day viewers over its 10-episode run.
Must-see TV.
And it's as close to as, yeah, absolutely, appointment TV. It was something that really connected with folks, probably partially because we don't have any live sports, as you said. But I think there was something to it anyway. I think this really would have resonated regardless. You've got the nostalgia of reliving the 80s and 90s, both basketball, but it's kind of those that cultural period anyway, through the soundtrack and commercials and archival footage, and not to mention just this absolutely incredible portrayal of greatness in sports. The access that these guys had, it just felt like you really got a real picture of who Michael Jordan was. I want to play a quick clip from one scene. He's smoking a big fat stogie in the locker room. He's got a baseball bat in his hand, kind of taking these loose, slow swings. And he's talking a little bit of trash, as was Jordan's way.
Let's see if all that trash talking starts when it's 0-0 instead of 5-6 point lead. That's where it starts.
I just love that he's talking about his former teammate B.J. Armstrong after B.J. Armstrong put up kind of a uncharacteristically good game in the 1998 Eastern Conference Finals. But I just love it because it was so vintage Jordan. It's just this combination of swagger and tenacity. It just really embodied what he was as a player.
Chris, you know, I lived in Chicago during that last glory season for the Bulls.
No, that's right. You're from Detroit, too, so you're a Pistons fan. What was that like in Chicago in that era?
Yeah, being an Isaiah Thomas fan, which is just going to get me dinged, during that era was interesting. But being in Chicago during that time, I think it's hard for people who weren't there to understand that Michael Jordan was carrying the entire city. I mean, he wore us on his shoulders.
Yeah, there was something beyond basketball about him. It was transcendent of sports. I mean, this is a time before social media, and yet he became the most famous person in the world. And he had this kind of combination of athleticism and grace and competitiveness. It just really created this kind of compelling figure. And I really feel like you get a good look at that through this documentary. It's one of the reasons I loved it so much. One of my favorite recurring features they have is they show different players that they're interviewing clips of other players talking about games or moments or rivalries. And I want to play this one clip here of Michael Jordan reacting to Gary Payton, who played for the Seattle Supersonics, nicknamed the Glove, maybe the greatest defender of all time, if not the greatest, one of the greatest defenders of all time. So he's talking about defending Michael Jordan in games 4 through 6 of the 96 finals. Listen to the way MJ reacts as he watches Gary Payton talk.
You just got to tire him out. And I kept hitting him and banging him and hitting him and banging him. It took a toll on Mike. It took a toll. And then I feel myself resting him a little bit. And then the series changed. And I wish I could have did it earlier. I don't know if the outcome would have been different, but it was a difference. and beating him down a little bit.
The Glove. I had no problem with the Glove.
I love that.
So that's Jordan guffawing in the background there? That was Michael
Absolutely.
Jordan laughing?
Yeah, and if you look at even just the screenshot of that moment, it is a full belly laugh. He is so tickled by the notion that somebody could have possibly contained him on the floor. The numbers are interesting. Gary Payton may have had a point. He played pretty good defense against him the second half of that series, but I just love what it tells you about the mindset of Michael Jordan, the competitive nature, this idea that when you step on the floor, this is my domain and nothing you can do matters.
So I want to stay on that for a second, Chris. We've got about 2 minutes left, and I think this is an important point. There's been a lot of chatter that Michael Jordan comes out of this not looking great. I think what occurs to me is we have a lot of talk about goats around Boston, you know, greatest of all time.
That's right.
Are we seeing what it takes to be a goat? I mean,
it's an interesting question.
I'd argue he's the goat.
It takes more than 2 minutes to dive into, but I think it was something Jordan himself said he was concerned about in doing this documentary. And a lot of the guys that played with him say, look, he's just super competitive. He pulled everyone along with him. Some of them push back against that notion a little bit, but I want to play one more clip. It's a really striking moment from the end of episode 7, where Jason Hare asked Jordan if all this winning came at the price of people seeing him as a nice guy. Here's part of how he answered that.
Winning has a price. And leadership has a price. So I pulled people along when they didn't want to be pulled. I challenge people when they don't want to be challenged. And I earned that right because my teammates came after me. They didn't endure all the things that I endured.
Michael Jordan is down in pain. Michael Jordan got taken out. He's hurt.
That moment really resonates because at this point, you're 7 episodes in. You've gone on this journey with him. But interesting, Jason Hare said that was the first 45 minutes of talking with Michael Jordan. He ends up at the end of that answer breaking down in tears and just says, break. And they cut, and that's the end of the episode 7. You know, some players push back against that, and even Celtic great Robert Parrish that said Larry Bird was a better leader, for example. But I think ultimately what everyone recognizes is it came out of his competitive nature and that desire to win.
So 2 things then, Chris. Lots of opportunity for compare and contrast for Boston sports fans with their own teams and watching this. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I will say there are multiple Larry Bird moments. My favorite is not suitable for air, but it's after Jordan knocks out the Pacers when Larry Bird was coaching. It's a very short exchange, but man, is it brilliant.
And if listeners want to find this, where do they do it?
It's on demand. It's an ESPN documentary. You can get it anywhere. You can get ESPN programming.
All right. That is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks. It's good to talk to
you. Yep. And Tom Brady's next. Keep your eyes open.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, stay with us. Coming up, many local graduates say that they're struggling to land their next opportunity and to stay on their feet. It's hard and we want to talk about it. We'll take your calls. I'm Tiziana Deering. That's coming up. This is Radio Boston. I treat you like a child and you're going to be named another enemy, not even a frenemy, because you'll get fried in the end. Over the past month, local universities have held class of 2020 graduations remotely. The pandemic has made a time of great celebration, also one of great uncertainty about what comes next. Many local graduates say they're struggling to land their next opportunity and to land on their feet.
I think it's really frustrating. I'd say that's the biggest word because I know it's no one's fault.
Like, not only am I not in school, I really don't have anything to do or any like set plan for the first time in my entire life.
Someone like me who goes to college for 4 or 5 years and they hope to get a job in the field that they did their work in. And now with the whole pandemic going on, I feel like I just kind of need to focus on just getting by with the job that I currently have.
It feels even more like I'm sluggishly entering the rest of my life.
When I came home, I remember I cried a couple times and I was just really upset and I talked to my mom because I was like, I don't understand why this is happening.
We are going to talk about the financial picture and the hunt for jobs among recent graduates and really for all of us. And we want to hear from you. We are all facing uncertainty. Are you looking for a job right now? Are you worried about your finances or future opportunities because of this crisis? Are you fresh out of school and scared? Or maybe you're comparing it to your experience in 2008. Or maybe you want to say something of encouragement and give a shout out to somebody who's just graduated. We welcome all of it. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So we've invited two recent graduates from the class of 2020 to join us for the first part of this conversation. Lee Granham from Suffolk University, who majored in government. Leah, sorry. She's currently in Fall River. Leah, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate you joining us. And Megan Timmons from UMass Lowell, who majored in history. She's currently in Tewksbury. Megan, congratulations to you too.
Thank you so much.
So it's really good of you two to take this time and sort of tell everyone about your experience. Leah, how are you feeling right now?
That's a really good question. You know, I play it over in my head again and again. And right now I just have a feeling of uncertainty, scaredness, and just a lot of, you know, just mixed feelings and emotions about the future. So that's where I'm at right now.
Megan, does that resonate with you? I mean, this is supposed to be such an exciting time. Are you excited or uncertain? How are you feeling?
I would definitely agree with Leah and say that it's a very nervous feeling, but also the idea that this will end at some point is also kind of a light at the end of the tunnel type of feeling, where eventually more opportunities will arise, but it's extremely nerve-wracking as to when those opportunities will arise, and that definitely causes a bit of panic.
Megan, what do you do to keep your eye on the light at the end of that tunnel?
I've been looking everywhere I possibly can to try to find work or something to keep me busy in the meantime. I'm still submitting applications to anywhere that's accepting them at present, regardless of when the start date is. And I'm looking up information about my possible future career choices so that I can kind of get more of an idea in the meantime.
And Leah, you're already thinking, I think, about your future career choice. You're a first-generation college student. I understand you're going to go on and get your master's in urban planning at Northeastern in the fall. But those are nighttime classes. Were you planning to work during the day in the fall? And if so, do you think you're going to be able to?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just restating what you just said, you know, being a first-generation college student, working is always at the forefront of my mind. Obviously, at the end of the day, I do value hard work and earning a paycheck and using that to obviously financially keep myself afloat. So the plan is to definitely find a job, whether it's in policy, government, any type of state or local government organization, where I can further my career and hopefully earn a paycheck at the end of the day and go to class at night is the plan for me. So hopefully I can see that through. But of course, with everything going on, there is a lot of uncertainty surrounding the job market and even securing a job in the fall.
So to both of you, what is at stake if you're not able to get a job in the field that you want? What do you feel like is at stake for you? Megan?
I've been kind of running through that question a lot recently. What I want to do, I eventually want to go into conservation in either a museum or public art setting. And where most museums are closed until at least August, I'm hoping that by the fall more internships will be available so that eventually I can continue to work toward graduate school. But it's very daunting knowing that I now have a degree that I have to wait longer for, since I'm trying to get experience in a field that can't necessarily host as much right now.
How about you, Leah?
Yeah, similarly, I am just, you know, still using those support systems that I have, hopefully with some networking opportunities through Suffolk, through their alumni network, and other opportunities with people that I've met in the past with other job opportunities. I'm hoping that those individuals can help me and guide me and hopefully find those jobs. But similarly, you know, there is a lot of uncertainty still with securing a job. And I hope that I can do my own research by using different online engines where I can search for jobs and hopefully find some type of, you know, availability. But right now, just kind of going with the flow and just seeing what pops up on those different searches online.
Leah, what's your message to other young people in your same situation?
A message for other young people in my situation is right now I feel as though a lot of us are panicking and we're constantly thinking about the future, constantly thinking about next steps, because obviously a lot of us are driven, even for students who aren't right now going through the college process. A lot of us want certain opportunities and didn't see this coming. But for me, what's been helping me and what I want to give advice for other young people right now, whether in college or not, is to just take it day by day. And tomorrow isn't promised, but just living in the moment now and just using those support systems, whether it's family, friends, things of that sort, can really create that positive energy. And that's the best thing that everybody can just do right now, is to remain positive and continue to lean on family and friends.
And Megan, any last words from, or words of advice from you to others who are listening?
I would say something pretty similar to what Leah said, in the sense that it's very easy to get caught up in everything that's going on, and taking it slow, taking it day by day, remembering what you personally can control and what isn't within your control is super important right now. And just doing what you can to your own ability is the most important thing at the end of the day.
That's Megan Timmons from UMass Lowell, who majored in history. Congratulations on your commencement, Megan, and we wish you the best. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Leah Granham from Suffolk University, who majored in government. Leah, you've already accomplished so much. Excited to see what you're going to do next as you go forward. Wishing you the best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, what's your message to people who are coming out of college now? What are your words of support or guidance? Have you been through something similar yourself? Does this feel like a time when you came out of school or made a job transition and weren't sure what was going to come next? Be a part of the community. Share the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. For some real perspective and analysis, we want to bring in Catherine Newman, who researches the impact of economic downturns. She is the interim chancellor at UMass Boston and is going to be serving as vice president for academic affairs for the UMass system. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, we've had you on the show before, and you are full of news and information and sometimes bad news in the research that you do. You know, we just heard from these two graduates. This is such a moment of unemployment. I mean, we are approaching the Great Depression. What are your reactions?
Well, my heart goes out to both of them, both as a scholar and a teacher and a university leader and as a mother of two young men who are facing similar kinds of constraints in the labor market. I think we are all hoping that life turns out for the best for them, but it is a daunting situation. And of course, not just for young people, but for all of us. There's nothing fun about a pandemic, and there's certainly nothing fun about approaching the Great Depression in terms of levels of unemployment. So this is a very difficult boat for all of us to be in. And I think your two guests have been remarkable in their steadfastness and in their ingenuity in thinking about how to make the best of a very difficult situation. But it is a very difficult situation, and it's likely to stay that way for a while.
You know, I just made a comparison to the Great Depression. Is that a fair comparison? Is that where we are?
This is the highest level of unemployment we have had since the Great Depression. And I think in some ways it's harder because as bad as the Great Depression was, it took a while for it to extend its grip on the worldwide economy. This came on in the space of about 2 months. The Great Depression took several years before it reached this level. So I think in many ways, this is a sharper shock to the international economy even than the Great Depression was.
You know, we've got a call I want to take here, Catherine. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Shira on the line from Needham. Shira, what's on your mind?
I wanted to say to the college students graduating something along the lines of, if you look historically, every generation comes out into its unique version of the world, and they have various challenges. including, you know, the World War II generation, the generation of the Depression, every generation. And this is the world, this is your world. It's the world that you're entering, and I hope that they will enter it with an open mind and readiness to engage and go to the next chapter.
Thanks for that, Shira. Catherine, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. You've looked across the generations. Is that the message? There's something really compelling about what Shira's saying.
I think it's very compelling, but I think we have to remember that for some generations, the challenges are much, much more serious than for others. And it's important to remember that because they were not the authors of this disaster. They are, unfortunately, the inheritors of it. And this is going to affect their lives in ways that are going to be very difficult. And we all need to remember that they didn't cause this problem. And that is something that Americans are not so good at remembering. We didn't even really remember it for the Depression generation. You know, when 25% of the American workforce was unemployed, the other 75% wasn't. And it is very unsettling to read the accounts of what it was like to be among the so, you know, impactfully destroyed when they met the other 75% who weren't so sympathetic and didn't remember that there was a Great Depression on. And I think we need to remind ourselves that these young people are not the authors of this problem, and we should cut them some slack when things start to revive, because they're not going to look as conventional as some of their counterparts who come along later or who came from before.
This is such a shared experience. I guess my instinct is that people will cut them some slack, that everyone understands, you know, no one manufactured this crisis. I'm sure that's going to be a politically controversial thing that I just said, but I think you know what I mean. It's so universally shared. Won't they get some slack from employers?
I hope so. But what tends to happen when the economy starts to recover, if a recession goes on long enough, is that people lose a lot of the contacts they needed to stay active in the networks that generate information about jobs. Some of them will lose the skills that they've had, or they will not be quite as shiny and new as new graduates might be. And sadly, people do start to look upon people whose biographies look unconventional, even if it wasn't their fault, as a little bit damaged. That is certainly what we can see when we look backwards into our history of the people who came of age in the 1930s, even in the early 1980s, when there was a double-digit unemployment problem that lasted for quite a while. It tends to follow them for many years, I'm afraid. So I would like to think people would have a charitable attitude, a positive attitude, an understanding perspective. Unfortunately, that's not the way it always works. So we're going to have to work at that.
I guess I'm wondering if the literature and the research on human capital and innovation suggests that if one isn't understanding, if one does look past this new generation of graduates, that that's a real mistake in terms of bringing everything we can in terms of human capital and human talent into our workforce.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think this is a lesson that all of your listeners need to bear in mind. Keep that human capital burnished. If the job market doesn't recover, follow the example that some of your guests have pursued. Try to stay in school for a while longer. Try to keep adding on some new skills that you didn't have before. Keep networking. Stay in touch with that college career center. Call people who are in the field you're interested in, even if they don't have jobs on offer, and just get their advice and their perspective. They may remember you when a job opening comes along. One thing that I do think is a source of optimism that we should bear in mind is that the generation that Leah and Megan represent, and even more the people coming behind them, is actually a pretty small generation. And typically, small generations do quite well as long as the economy is in reasonable condition, because there aren't very many of them. And when things start to grow, we need more workers. And we have been in a period of such dramatic difference in the recent past, we had very tight labor markets. And one of the reasons we had tight labor markets is that economic growth was taking place against the demography of a really small generation. And that's not going to change. We know who's been born. There aren't very many of them. And so it should, that should help Leah and Megan when things start to reopen.
Catherine, I want to grab a call here. We've got Nick on the line from Jamaica Plain. Nick, go ahead.
Hi there. Hi. I just wanted a quick piece of advice as a millennial who came into the workforce in 2008. You know, I had dreams. I'm a music educator. I had big dreams of being a, you know, a big band director. But my first job availabilities were teaching little kids in time situations, and it ended up really working out for the best. To the graduates, you know, it's not quite as severe of a situation in 2008 as now, but keep your options open and be flexible.
Thanks for that advice, Nick. Catherine, what about the comparison between this cohort and the graduates from 2008?
Well, two things. I think the advice to be flexible is very, very wise, because you have to grab opportunities as they come to you, and they may not be exactly what you were looking for. In terms of the experience with 2008, well, that was a pretty severe depression, but not nearly as bad as this one. It just took, it had a long, long overhang. So one of the things we don't know about this recession is whether it will have a V-shape, meaning we will have a quick recovery, or a long, slow recovery, which is what happened after 2008. It really took almost a decade before the job market fully recovered from the recession of 2008. We don't really know what this downturn is going to look like. So let's hope that it's more like a V-shape.
So Catherine, I want to get to at least one more subject before we run out of time. UMass President Marty Meehan said in an online forum yesterday that he's worried about the future of accessibility in public education, about accessible public education. He spoke about his concerns about what's going to happen if the state isn't able to invest in institutions that provide education opportunities to low-income students. Here's a little of what he said.
If we leave these folks behind, we're not going to have economic prosperity in this country. This is an essential a part of getting the economy going again and making sure these students get what they need.
What about that? What role do institutions like UMass, community colleges play in this recovery and for these young people?
Well, they play an absolutely enormous role. First of all, higher education, especially in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, is an enormous employer. I believe the University of Massachusetts may be the largest employer in the state. So we are huge as an employer. We are also the main human capital factory. We are the institutions, all of us in public higher education, that educate the largest number of people, especially who remain in the Commonwealth. But if you put all higher education together, it's just an extraordinarily important industry in Massachusetts, which is why we often speak of ourselves as eds and meds, the two big industries in the state. So reviving universities is very important for their contribution to the economy, their contribution to research. And of course, we're all waiting on research now to solve this pandemic problem. And it comes out of laboratories like our medical school in Worcester and our engineering programs in Lowell and our urban universities like the one where I work. So all of the universities taken collectively are incredibly important for training an outstanding professional workforce. So I couldn't agree with Marty Meehan more about that. What does worry all of us in public higher education is the ability of the state government to invest. It's going to be under a lot of pressure. We all know that. There are many worthy domains that the state will need to fund. But higher education is certainly one of them, because all the families in Massachusetts depend on us to make it possible for their young people to develop the skills and experience and networks they need to go forth and prosper. So it is a very important social investment.
Catherine, we've got about 20 seconds for one more question. So just very briefly, one note of optimism for the graduates.
They are a small generation in an economy which up until now was thriving, and we have every reason to believe will be thriving again, but it's going to take a little while. So try to stay in school if you can. Keep piling up those skills. Network wherever possible. Remember that your families are a source of support. That is not something to be ashamed of, that you went home and that you sheltered with your parents. They are there as a resource for you, And that is something we should be proud of, not to take each other down a notch for. So I think we band together, and that is a strength of American families, not a weakness.
That's Catherine Newman of UMass Boston. I really appreciate you being with us today. Thank you.
My pleasure.
So finally today, we want to end on a venerated Radio Boston tradition, which is hearing a bit from area commencement speeches. This year, as we've heard, college graduations are different. They're either postponed or they're occurring in some fashion online. And the world grads are entering into is far from certain. But what is certain is that the coronavirus hasn't stopped leaders from a variety of fields from turning on the webcam and offering inspiring words. Earlier this week, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi offered this message to the women of Smith College, connecting this year's graduates to the visionary female leaders of Smith College's history.
As you begin the next chapter in this time of uncertainty, it is even more necessary that you make your own environment. In the tradition of these iconoclasts and visionaries who came before, I urge you to know your power. Leadership is about having confidence in your vision, your knowledge, your strategic thinking, and how that connects to the aspirations of others. Recognize that you are the unique person you are, with your own special power to shape the future for yourself and for our country. You never know what opportunities the futures hold, but we must be ready. I had no intention of running for office or for leadership, but when the opportunity presented itself, I was ready. My strength sprang from my love of my family and the comfort of good friends. So my closing advice is to stay close and to treasure your family and friends.
UMass Amherst went in a little bit different route this year. Still virtual, they had alums, famous and otherwise, current students, and a few celebrities offer 10-second or less messages for the grads. Chancellor Kumble Sebaswamy kicked off the online celebration.
Let me say what everybody is thinking. This is weird. Like, super weird.
And then in comes the rousing music, and we heard from Rachel Maddow, Governor Baker, Senator Warren, Bob Kraft, Congresswoman Presley, and Patriot Safety Devin McCourty.
Congratulations to all the 2020 graduates. You did it. You passed the finish line. Congratulations. Don't let anyone ever tell you you can't do something. Go chase your dreams and be great.
Actors Rachel Dratch and Ben Affleck echoed McCourty's message.
My advice would be to reach for the stars, and you will go far. I know you can't go far right now. With everything that's going on, you can't go too far, but don't worry. In the not-too-distant future, I know it, you will go far. All of you, you're all going far. You're all going to the stars, as far as I'm concerned.
Be honest, be accountable, help people, stand up for what's right. When you're wrong, own it and apologize. Forgive others, forgive yourself. Be grateful, have empathy. Know your worth. You'll get what you settle for. Just because it's online doesn't mean it's true. Trust me, and don't read the comments.
So on those wise and hopeful notes, we end today's show by saying congratulations to all our area students. You are our future, and we look to you to make tomorrow brighter than today. Thank you in advance for doing it.